transmitting live from the heart of Times Square on 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio for the Tri-State Area. This is Trump Watch, a weekly series examining how President Donald J. Trump and his administration are changing the world we live in. I'm your host, Jesse Lent.
When I return home to the White House, I will celebrate Independence Day with a special salute to America on our National Mall, July 4th. I hope everybody can be there. It's going to be big. We're making it especially big because we're more proud of our country today than we have been in many, many, many decades.
That was President Trump addressing members of the U.S. military stationed at Asan Air Base in South Korea on June 30th, footage courtesy of the White House press office. On Tuesday, the Washington Post reported that the National Park Service is diverting nearly $2.5 million earmarked to improve the nation's parks to cover the costs for President Trump's July 4th celebration on the National Mall in D.C. The president has pledged that his Independence Day military parade will be the, quote, show of a lifetime. Hello and welcome to Trump Watch. The president wasn't alone at his appearance at the base in South Korea that we just heard. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter and White House advisor, were both invited to join him on stage together, prompting the president to quip, "What a beautiful couple." The presence of Ivanka Trump at high-level meetings with world leaders throughout the G20 summit in Japan last weekend appeared to confound some of the diplomats in attendance, with National Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde shooting Ivanka a look after the president's daughter interjected in a conversation between Lagarde, British Prime Minister Theresa May, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in a moment that went viral. This, coupled with Ivanka's appearance alongside Pompeo at the base in South Korea, has presumably left those already confused about who is leading U.S. foreign policy, particularly our military policy, more confounded than ever. Joining us now live on the phone to help untangle where the power center is in Washington, D.C. right now regarding international relations is Adam Weinstein, National Security Editor for The New Republic. Hello, Adam. Welcome to Trump Watch. Thanks so much for making some time for us today.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Let's start with the president's 4th of July spectacular. What can we expect to happen tomorrow, and how unique is it for a U.S. president to plan and host a military parade of this size?
It's hard to say that there's much precedent for this. Obviously, there's been lots of pomp and circumstance. There have been military presence in presidential inauguration parades over the years. It was probably a little bit more common, I think, during the periods in the world wars than it has been in recent history. But what you're going to see tomorrow has a lot more in common with the French Bastille Day celebrations and the Russian Red Square or Independence Square celebrations that you would see during the years of the Soviet Union and in a lot of post-Soviet Russian capitals. It's not exactly easy to see what the connection is between M1 Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles and the 4th of July and the Declaration of Independence and the signers in Independence Hall. But that is the connection that Trump has been urgently trying to make. And this is something that he's been wanting to do since about 2017. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the offing.
In an op-ed entitled, "Ivanka Trump's Asia Trip Wasn't Just Awkward, It Will Harm American Diplomacy," Daniel B. Shapiro of NBC News makes the argument that having Ivanka on hand at the G20 with National Security Advisor John Bolton noticeably absent, quote, renders all other officials in the U.S. government afterthoughts. Do you agree?
I think that the problem is not just Ivanka. The problem is also Jared Kushner, who made a very public trip to Iraq that was roundly criticized and ridiculed in 2017 and is now somehow spearheading the Trump administration's Middle East peace process. It's not just them. Also, it's also people who are appointed in the Trump cabinet who may be overstepping the bounds of their portfolio. Bolton, for example, who's not a cabinet member, of course, he's the national security advisor, has been reportedly calling up lower-level employees in the Pentagon and giving them taskings, which is an abject no-no. It's something that the Secretary of Defense is supposed to protect against. You've also had Secretary Pompeo from the Secretary of State doing a bunch of things that you would generally expect defense personnel to be doing. So it goes deeper than just Ivanka, but obviously it's troubling having unelected members of the presidential family acting in very official capacities when a lot of the people that would ordinarily be doing this, civil servants in the United States government, simply either aren't there or those posts aren't filled. So there's a very concerning power void happening here, and what's filling it is even more concerning.
Let's get into that. Starting with Pompeo, what are some of the roles, like you mentioned, that are untraditional or non-traditional, should I say, for a Secretary of State to engage in?
Well, if you look at last month, it was really an exceptional month. There were a couple of events that sort of suggested the Trump administration was trying to move fast onto a war footing with Iran. And a lot of things moved fast at the beginning of the month after that incident in the Gulf of Oman when there were attacks on two Japanese-flagged tankers. Before any other member of the administration had weighed in, Pompeo was giving a State Department briefing where he said at the outset, Iran did this without any evidence. The evidence that was later given, which was coordinated between Pompeo and the State Department, was U.S. Navy surveillance video of the aftermath of Iranians who were ostensibly helping in the recovery and rescue process. And already there was sort of a short-circuiting there of how quickly a defense national security issue suddenly was punted over to the Secretary of State to make a public accusation. Generally, you expect your Secretary of State to de-escalate tensions and to favor diplomacy, and that didn't seem to be what was happening. They were starting to set lines in the sand. Subsequently, you saw Pompeo taking a trip unaccompanied by a Secretary of Defense down to U.S. Central Command and U.S. Special Operations Command in Tampa. Those are the operational combatant commands where generals run the operations of war, basically, in the Middle East theater. And that we could find, nor could the State Department, when I asked them, find any precedent for a Secretary of State going down to do that kind of a trip without a Secretary of Defense or a President or somebody who's actually in the military chain of command.
Go ahead.
Go on. Well, given enough time, the State Department responded that it was a routine meeting, it had been planned in advance, and that Secretary Pompeo was going to be doing the listening, not the talking. But Henry Kissinger has this concept of propinquity, which is just proximity to power. If you're close to power, you have power. And in the absence of a Secretary of Defense, that was actually also the day that Acting Defense Secretary Shanahan took himself out of the running for his position because of reports of domestic abuse. At that event, the person who had the propinquity was Pompeo. He is the person who is showing his face, showing the flag, if you will, to the generals who would actually be making operational decisions in the Middle East. That's very concerning for our chain of command.
What do you make of Pompeo brushing off the norm-shattering nature of the visit by saying he was simply saving the generals and their staffs a trip to Washington?
Having worked for an operational general staff in Iraq in 2008-2009, I know that we also have secure video links to do these things. So that's sort of a non sequitur. Taking an unprecedented physical trip and not, actually asking, at the very least, a deputy undersecretary of defense, somebody in the operations, somebody from OSD, the Office of the Security of Defense, to accompany you on that trip, that says pretty much everything that needs to be said. Now, it should be said, Pompeo, he's no stranger or babe in the woods when it comes to this. He was a CIA director, and he also is a West Point graduate and a former Army officer. So, certainly, he probably is more engaged on national security issues as with a military bent than most secretaries of state would be. And in an administration where all of these other things, Jared, Ivanka, aren't happening, massive historical vacancies in important positions in state and DOD, there might be something to that. But Pompeo's moves should be very concerning to anybody who's tracking national security priorities for the U.S. right now.
How are those vacancies affecting national security?
There's been a lot of great reporting on this. For example, Wesley Morgan at Politico has done a lot. Barbara Starr at CNN have spoken both on background and on the record to as many people as they can. And, you have right now 18 senior posts in the DOD that are either completely vacant or being filled by somebody who is an acting Secretary of the Army, an acting Secretary of the Air Force, bunches of undersecretaries. There's a whole mess when it comes to the acting Secretary of Defense right now, Mark Esper, and whether he'll be able to stay in that capacity when he's officially nominated. This is unprecedented. And what all of the experts are saying is, at the very best, when you have all of these people who are basically continually auditioning for their jobs, first of all, it makes them very much beholden to the White House and the nominating powers in ways that civil servants have a little bit more wiggle room in. And second of all, it also ensures, as one person said, they might be able to make sure that the trains run on time, but they're not going to be able to have a vision about where the trains should be headed. So it really sort of invests a lot more power in the people who have proximity, for example, your Secretary of State right now, and in the people who are not filling those positions, the White House. So it's a very unitary executive that we seem to have right now with all those vacancies.
Right. As you mentioned, on July 1st, CNN's Barbara Starr reported that the current acting Defense Secretary, Mark T. Esper, may need to step down in order to be confirmed by the Senate due to federal regulations. This means President Trump could be appointing his third acting Defense Secretary in under 30 days with the departure of Shanahan, as you mentioned. What do these personnel missteps mean for the way that U.S. foreign policy operates?
Yeah, well, on a very granular scale, I wouldn't expect a huge cataclysmic problem out of that. It's expected that should Esper have to step down from that acting position while his nomination is submitted, it would be current Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer who steps up on his behalf and acts as the Secretary of Defense. Those men have a pretty close working relationship right now as service secretaries. And so, you're not talking about a very radical change there. Now, that said, it's all up to the President of the United States whether or not that's the way things actually run. And also, as you point out, if you include Mattis in the mix, this would be the fourth Secretary of Defense, the fourth head of the Pentagon that we've had in about a half a year, which is also largely unprecedented. While we have multiple operations going on around the world, and we're rattling the saber with a couple of other nations. So it's deeply concerning. And in the absence of any consistency, everybody sort of tries to look at the White House and read the tea leaves. And as anybody who's looked at the president's Twitter account recently knows, that's a very daunting proposition.
You mentioned the number of positions that have acting heads right now. Why do you think this president is so fond of using the acting head of different federal organizations? I don't recall a president appointing so many acting secretaries for such a long time, at least in my lifetime.
I mean, we elected a man president who ran a reality television show where everybody was constantly auditioning for their jobs, and the greatest pleasure that the viewer could derive was watching Donald Trump fire somebody. So he has, I think it appeals both to his desire to really retain control and not delegate, but it also serves that sort of the attention that he gets from creating a spectacle out of something where there generally is none. It's not that the Pentagon is a black box that we don't know how it operates. It could always be more transparent. But he really has turned that and all of the other U.S. government agencies into these sort of mysterious operations. And in order to understand where they may go, you really have to keep your eyes fixed on the president. And I think that's the way he likes it. He's said as much. He's said before in interviews, I like acting. He prefers that, I think, to people who feel like they have tenure.
I'm speaking with Adam Weinstein, national security editor for The New Republic. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. I want to get back to John Bolton for a moment. Do you get any sense from the reporting you've seen if there was a strategic reason for the president dispatching the national security advisor to Mongolia during the G20 summit?
There's been a lot of, in this modern age of sort of United States Kremlinology, a lot of it is focused on Bolton, a man whose fortune seemed to have really paid off when he was appointed and when Iran suddenly came to the forefront of American priorities, because that was the thing that he's basically been lobbying for both in and out of office throughout his career, was a tough talk in Iran. Bolton's fortunes seem to have really slipped of late. Possibly that's because there's some daylight between him and Pompeo. He had a very strong advocate in Pat Shanahan over at DOD when Shanahan was the acting secretary. Shanahan basically acceded to Bolton giving taskings to people in the Pentagon. And I don't think you're going to see that so much out of Esper or some of the other, appointees that do exist in the House, in E-Ring, in the DOD. So between that and the fact that I think Trump is also, he has sort of expressed a kind of, I don't want to say pacifism or isolationism, but a reluctance to actually get into military engagements when he took credit for, not declaring war against Iran at the 11th hour, that sort of created a real wedge between him and Bolton. And I think that Bolton may very well be on the outs right now, but it's not clear what bodes for his tenure or what might follow him at the White House.
And certainly many political observers have pointed out this pattern where the president escalates a situation as he did in North Korea or in Iran and then backs away and claims victory or some kind of solution for the problem.
Yeah, and he's also notoriously terrible at, notwithstanding his television show, the president is terrible at actually firing people. And so it may very well be that he wants Bolton out, but, he's not making those moves. It doesn't appear that he really needs to if he can have Jared or Ivanka traveling with him and basically fulfilling sort of official roles that you might expect an appointee to be doing. So, there's a lot of workarounds to just simply terminating somebody with whom you might have a difference of opinion. And it feels like Trump can find every single one of those opportunities.
And speaking of differences of opinion, I always feel that it's important to point out to listeners in conversations like this that whatever your own personal thoughts are about U.S. military action, the U.S. so-called military complex, or national security, the more secretive who is making these national security decisions is kept, the more trouble U.S. presidents have typically gotten themselves into over the years. I'm thinking of the early days of the Vietnam War, for example, when few Americans even knew we were involved in a military action in the region. Would you agree with that assessment?
The real basis for democracy in general and the basis for American civil military control in particular is consistency and a modicum of transparency. I think all of us who have worked in and around and covered the national security establishment would like to see more transparency at all times. But you're starting to see sort of historic levels of opacity. As soon as the Trump administration came in, the precise troop levels in Afghanistan, for example, were not shared as they routinely were before. A lot of those sorts of moves, really small ones that incrementally changed the landscape, have really started to add up. And now in the absence of, there's also an absence of accountability. If we don't have, a deputy undersecretary for manpower affairs, who do we actually hold whose feet do we hold to the fire when there is a problem with the civilian or military workforce? It's not clear sometimes, and it really is a net negative for democracy and for our representation and our security.
Okay, so beyond Mike Pompeo, who else really has the president's ear in regards to foreign policy or military policy? Is Vice President Mike Pence, for example, still in on those kind of decisions?
Not entirely clear. Pence has certainly taken a public role in, for example, advocating for the administration's shifting position on North Korea. He took a very public trip to the DMZ and I think has sort of attempted to establish some gravitas or some consistency in traditional Republican political ways that the president doesn't really take to naturally. Now, in terms of who actually may have who have President Trump's ear on security issues, it's a variety of people from a variety of corners. One, for example, that we know about when it came to the rumors that President Trump might pardon some war criminals, accused and convicted war criminals. We looked at Pete Hegseth, who is a former Army officer and conservative firebrand who is a host on Fox and Friends. And it turned out that while he was advocating for war crimes pardons on Fox News, he was also quietly, privately lobbying the president in their golf encounters to make some of these pardons. And so I think you're seeing a lot more of that kind of informal counsels to the president, probably happening at Mar-a-Lago, happening at certain of his other clubs that he goes to on the weekends, that are really rapidly taking over official visits and, you know, official roles of advisors. And that's concerning because we probably don't know about all of them, or maybe even some of the most important ones.
Are there specific foreign policy organs of the U.S. government that you believe are potentially more dangerous or making things more dangerous in the era of Trump?
You always see a hazard. And I think anybody who lived through the George W. Bush administration understands the inherent hazards of somebody who comes into the Pentagon and, for example, wants to do a rapid revolutionary reorganization and maybe creates new bureaucracies that might, like an Office of Special Plans that looks at, re-evaluates the intelligence community's analysis of Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. Right now, you look at the National Security Council, again, currently being run by John Bolton, but an NSC that really is kind of populated with people who are ideologically inclined towards confrontation. They're very hawkish. And that, I think, is probably the nexus where you want to look and see who's actually, you know, holding the portfolios for different regions. That's the place that I would probably be most concerned about. But, you know, to answer your question briefly, we may not know where some of the real centers of gravity are in this administration with national security decisions. And that's what should be really most concerning right now.
You mentioned Vice President Mike Pence's trip to the demilitarized zone separating the two Koreas. President Trump met with Kim Jong-un there at the DMZ on Sunday. Do you see anything of value coming out of that meeting, which was, of course, prompted after President Trump made the invitation via Twitter?
President Trump obviously puts a lot of stock into person-to-person relations. He's practiced that with Putin. He's practiced that with Kim Jong-un. He's practiced that with a great deal of people whom previous presidents would have held at a bit of an arm's length and certainly would not have met with in private for any, you know, great amount of time without a great deal of briefing and advice and advisors on hand. I think we should be concerned that Trump also has this tendency of declaring victory in a negotiation when he really has gotten no major concessions that weren't on the table before. And I think that's probably the case with North Korea. It doesn't cost the North Koreans anything to say, oh, fine, we won't do any more nuclear testing, because they've already done all the relevant testing that they need to do, for example. It doesn't cost them anything to say, oh, we will freeze our program, as opposed to, you know, dismantling warheads that currently exist. I think the real danger is in President Trump sort of making up new policy on the fly on the basis of these conversations that he has with Moon, who, you know, it should go without saying, but let's say it anyway, is a murderous dictator who is probably not someone you would want to trust everything that comes out of his mouth without a great deal of briefing and advice.
Your last major foreign policy article was about Iran. In the last 60 seconds we have here, to the extent you can summarize it, what is your sense of the current prevailing view at the White House about a conflict with that country?
I think President Trump's actually very reluctant to get into it. I think that he, while he has seen some great political benefit or perceived some political benefit to tough talk and to, you know, distancing himself, for example, from Obama's nuclear trade deal, which is now dead in the water, I think he's starting to realize that you open a heck of a Pandora's box by even a limited strike on Iran, and is now trying to figure out how to manage the hawkishness that exists in his own camp, his own party, and his own administration with the reality is that he doesn't want to own another major conflict in the Middle East. I honestly cannot tell you how that's going to play out, but I wouldn't trust him to be able to manage that without some serious intervention from other educated hands.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Adam Weinstein, National Security Editor for The New Republic. You're listening to Trump Watch. My name is Jesse Lent. That's all for this week. Reggie Johnson engineered this program live. You can hear all 120 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent at soundcloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a happy 4th of July, however you decide to spend it, and join us again next week when we'll break down a different aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time.